Following the practice of yesterday, I'd like to thank the organizers very warmly for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. What I want to do today is to share an ongoing draft of an article that is going to be published with Contemporary Security Policy in the spring, I hope, given that the reviewers accept it. And what this piece of research is doing is that it's reflecting on the human protection regime in Africa. If we want to use the word of regime, we can think of other concepts, but as the human protection regime as a site of practice, leaning on practice theory. We heard a bit about practice theory yesterday, to study how values connected with peace building and pacifism that are right at the heart and center of Africa's peace and security institutions are becoming conflated with, fused with, counterinsurgency and counterterrorism goals and objectives. And what does that do to how African institutions enact civilian protection, and does it have practical consequences? We touched on this question yesterday, whether the changes in rationales and logics would mean that there's a changed character of policy delivery, and if that has practical effects that we can study. I think that with the lens of sociological militarization, hopefully married with practice theory in a nice way, we can get to these tangible, concrete political effects of changing logics. This is also, I hope, part in a bigger research project that we are now developing with Chiara and Christina. So this is initial thoughts and initial work along that line as well. So the three points I want to make, we'll see how much time I'm given by the sometimes generous, sometimes strict chair, is that the first is that within African institutions, there's been a pragmatic decision, we can say, that's what's important is not using strictly the label of R2P and referring to R2P whenever the possibility is given, but rather what matters is to point to the fact that policies minimize civilian harm, and to say that we are enacting the content of the idea. So what's behind R2P, the cause that we called it yesterday, and the reason why we are supposedly all here, the ethical luggage of R2P, that's what's being implemented through African peace and security institutions. So protection of civilians has been a much more agreeable term in policymaking in Africa. Sometimes this thinking is stretched too far. So we hear academics and political observers saying that, look, there's so much R2P implementation in Africa. Look at this policy mechanism. Look at that policy mechanism. Look at everything we've been doing so far since we created this institution. And that's taking it too far. We have to find a way of looking at what's within, conceivably within R2P implementation, and what's broadly peace and security affairs. So that's a problem that we have, I think, at the moment when looking at Africa. But language, also a point we touched on yesterday, language absolutely matters. To say that African leaders and African civil society have absolutely understand the importance of R2P as pretext to marry together a lot of political objectives in order to get something done. And Libya was a prime example of this and will continue to have repercussions for the African Union's relationship with the UN Security Council, is having consequences and will continue to have consequences for that relationship, because it showed just how powerful R2P can be as a pretext to smuggle regime change goals into something else that is minimizing civilian harm, but through certain modes of doing it. So the second point is that current developments, discursive developments and material developments, are indicating a militarization of the human protection regime in Africa. And this is, if you speak to policymakers and officials, AU officials in Addis Ababa, this is a no-brainer, kind of. It's a straw man. They would think, yeah, of course militarization is ongoing, duh. You know, but I think what we've been doing in the literature, in the academic literature, we've wanted to stick with constructivism, norms shaping research, life cycles of norms, and we're talking about the efficiency of implementation or bringing words to deeds. I think that framework is getting us stuck in not capturing actually the developments that we need to see that have worrying political consequences, and that we are actually implicated in. So one of the benefits of looking at this as a human protection regime, rather than looking at the APSA, the African Peace and Security Architecture, is that when we look at institutions in isolation and treat them as sort of stagnant bodies that implement policies, then we miss the transnational connections. We miss that this regime is connected very clearly to donor objectives, to donor flows of money. There's a political economy of furthering militarization goals, most clearly within the counterterrorism agenda at the moment, because there's expectations on the part of the donors that intelligence sharing, rapid deployment, information sharing between countries that face terrorist threats. These things are given, are treated as prioritized and given more donor money and more training logistical packages of that kind. So there's a political economy to this. The third point is to argue that, to study this through the sociological approach to militarization, which is a terribly open-ended approach to militarization that IR theorists will not like, seems useful because we can bridge policy and practice. So rather than asking when are they going to make words, turn words into deeds, we're asking, all these things that we are witnessing, the daily mundane practices, how are they connected up to the values such as R2P civilian protection that we are interested in? And in fact, we see not that principles are not being turned into practice, rather the opposite. They're definitely being turned into practice, but maybe in ways that we need to consider the ethical consequences of. So to tame the sociological approach to militarization, I want to look at the interconnections between militarization and the practice turn in IR, because the practice turn in IR gives us a couple of analytical tools that are useful and that are more agreeable in the IR theory community that we can use to be more methodologically rigorous, to put it that way. Okay, so let's see how much of this I can get through in my time. So I mentioned that R2P in Africa, African leaders, they have a reluctance to bring up the term of R2P, and AU officials know that rather than risking to block important decisions that will minimize civilian harm, they refer to civilian protection instead of R2P, or they refer to solidarity. So it's trying to go back to Pan-African political principles that are part of the very important normative, ethical underlying basis for African peace and security institutions. And they talk about solidarity. This is solidarity between African heads of state, that it requires senior, respected African heads of state that can tell other African heads of state in a very suave political diplomatic way behind the scenes that what you're doing is completely unacceptable. We're trying to set up a normative order in Africa, and what you're doing at the moment to your own population is far beyond accepted limits. So basically stop. And that way of having red lines and telling each other behind the scenes, that's solidarity. Solidarity can also be invoked in so many other ways. It can be invoked solidarity with civilian communities that are suffering. It can be invoked in the sense of when Nigeria needs to justify to its population that it sends troops yet again to a neighboring country and to help them in a political crisis, they say, we have to show solidarity with our African brothers and sisters. And this is also going back to very, very historical Pan-African political principles of state practice. It's to be expected that you do what you can to minimize civilian harm. This is part of R2P implementation in Africa. Solidarism can be a problematic principle because it allows African regimes, of course, to hold each other's backs for longer than they should. But it is also currently the major way in which African states can tell each other to stop without having to do it so publicly that it also becomes an international issue and an international concern. So Pan-African values, as I said, feed into R2P implementation just as much peace-building values. There's a great study I read by Abu Jang that argues from normative theory international law that embodied in the AU Constitutive Act is an innovative peace-building disposition. What he wants to read into this, that if only we start implementing what's in the AU Constitutive Act, Africa's political future can be reimagined. Basically, we see a radically alternative order developing in Africa. Now, I can, from my perspective, I think he's too optimistic. I think this is very aspirational, and he agrees that he writes that also. It's largely aspirational, but that these normative principles will help African political order go in a progressive direction. That's most important for him. I'm sorry, my time management has been a bit off, I can see. Protection of civilians, to move on. So responsiveness to civilian protection goes straight back to Pan-African principles and ethical values. That's very important. Abu Jang says that these are being ever more codified, an ever more codified duty to act. Why practice theory and the sociological approach to militarization is so important is because then it helps us look at how seemingly mundane practices by AU officials and by donors that may, for example, a donor may decide to fund a little tiny civilian capacity into a mission, and that tiny civilian capacity, which is two people, can start experimenting. They start experimenting and writing a guideline. Initially, that guideline is just supposed to guide the work of one unit in one mission, say in AMISOM in Somalia. So a few civilian planners started saying, there have been accusations that in AMISOM, our troops are actually causing civilian harm. So there's so much collateral damage that international media and global civil society are soon going to make this into a huge issue unless we do something. Those very few civilian planners can start think of inventive ideas of having more civilian protection mainstreamed throughout the mission, even though AMISOM was a counterinsurgency mission. So it means that the counterinsurgency, counterterrorism ideals and objectives that were fundamental to the authorizing of AMISOM in the first place in 2007 are becoming increasingly fused with this expectation of multidimensionality, civilian capacity in the mission, civil-military relations, the fact that the military part of the mission has to share information with the civilian component, something which has not prior to this been done in African missions. I'm ignoring you now. and AMISOM is just one example. I wish I could go on. But what is important about these mundane bureaucratic and operational trial and error practices is that they lead up to an emerging conversation about accountability within these peace and security practices. So accountability is now being translated into codes of conduct. So there's a draft, important draft. They're not yet accepted, shared, disseminated, ratified, but they're draft, codes of conduct. They're draft proposals of how to make this best practice in all AU peace operations from now on. There is a civilian casualty tracking and a response cell in AMISOM that I'm hoping to look further into as I continue writing this article, that basically shows that although the military section of AMISOM is still not sharing its information with the civilian tracking cell, this is still an important initiative that will lead to the African Union having to include such cells in future missions. And those are important examples of how basically counterinsurgency ideals and values are being fused with the peace-building values that inspired the R2P language in the African Union in the first place. And I think I have to stop there. I hope I get more questions at the end. Thank you.